This podcast is an initiative of the Australian Intercollegiate Meat Judging Association to showcase the career paths within the meat processing industry. ICMJ is a not-for-profit association which aims to provide opportunities for students to learn, building the pool of intelligent young meat industry representatives into the future. ICMJ does this through a series of events across Australia and overseas. For more information, head to the website icmj.com.au. Born, raised and educated in Melbourne, Tom Maguire says he couldn't have imagined a career in agriculture as a young man. But that's exactly what's happened. Tom has now worked for some of the biggest names in meat in Australia and around the world. I'm Amy McCosker and I started my conversation with Tom Maguire by asking how he became interested in meat production and processing after starting his life in the city.
I started at De La Salle College in Malvern in Melbourne, so you can't get any more city than Malvern in Melbourne. I never grew up thinking that I would be part of rural Australia, other than every second weekend I was lucky enough to be able to go out on my uncle's dairy farm in Gippsland and earn a little bit of money helping out. But other than that, I've been a city slicker until my career took me in the direction of the meat industry.
So when did things start to change?
I went through high school, and I love interviewing people for jobs now and saying, what do you want to do? Because when I was finishing high school, I had absolutely no idea of where I was heading. I did okay at my HSC, which was leaving of high school at that time, and ended up doing law and commerce at Melbourne University. And that was largely because I got the marks to get in there. As I said, I didn't really ever think I would be a lawyer. I went through that process and started a career in law and didn't like it very much. I joined, and I was lucky enough by word of mouth to meet someone and join the industrial section of the Victorian Farmers Federation as an industrial officer, and got involved meeting lots of farmers across rural Victoria, helping them out with employment law. From there, I met a person, Tony Rowden, who I'm still greatly indebted to, who introduced me to the Australian meat industry and what was then the Meat and Allied Trades Federation of Australia, which after several iterations became what's now the Australian Meat Industry Council. I worked there in industrial relations for a number of years, but then got opportunities to be involved in general policy. And what I'd love to say to people listening to this is, whenever you get opportunities, take them, right? Because they often don't come around twice. When I got involved in general policy, I got to experience the length and breadth of the meat industry, about all the issues that were facing meat processors come food safety, market access, industrial relations, of course, was still a core part of that, food regulation. And more importantly, got to meet lots and lots of great family businesses who I still know today, and many of them I count as friends. And Amy, it's those people that are the reason why I think, if I add it up, it's almost 20 years later, I'm still in the industry.
Can you remember at the beginning what your first impressions were?
No, I'll be honest, I remember being scared half to death, sitting at these board tables with all these senior, men that had been in the industry and owned their own businesses and were greatly successful. And I made an early career of just sitting there listening, because it wasn't because I was a particularly good listener when I was that age. It was just that I didn't know what I was talking about. So I figured out that I should sit there and listen as much as I could, so I would learn what was going on. Got to meet those people. And, they are some of the nicest people on earth, genuine people that, have the industry at heart. I've been fortunate enough to meet lots of farmers too, and the same, that it just... people that you would very happily invite into your house for, a cup of coffee or a beer, depending on the time of day.
Now, you mentioned that you began your career in that sort of policy and legislation space. Are there any you know, things that you learnt at that time that still stick in your mind or that you reflect on as being, you know, important? I suppose you're in a different space now. But, you know, those early days in that policy and legislation back sort of 20, 30 years ago, was there any important learnings then?
What you learn is to understand, and it's something, again, I really recommend for anyone listening, is what's really important when you're dealing with people is to understand their background and their perceptions. The industry gets so frustrated from time to time with government and policymakers, and it's often like they're speaking another language. And it's very, very difficult to come to meet common ground when you're trying to deal with the detail. What's really important is that you spend the time to understand where people are coming from, their background, what they're trying to achieve. And it's by getting that deeper understanding of that you can make some headway and reach some common ground. So that kind of early learning about how to get in the heads of policymakers and bureaucrats is, I think, still serving me well.
You know, you move from that space onto working for two of the biggest players in the Australian meat industry, JBS and Tees. And I know these roles took you all over the world and you must have met some amazing people and been in some amazing situations. Could you share some of those with us?
Yeah, this industry's been fantastic to me and I've been hugely fortunate. I have literally got the opportunity to travel the world, both representing the companies I've worked for and the industry at different levels. I've been taken by customers around the Great Wall of China. I've been fortunate enough to be to the Capitol building and the White House in Washington, D.C., dealing with policy matters. I've gone to places in Japan, Korea, and Europe that, you know, I just would have never visited, and you get to meet some wonderful people and, you know, you always learn from those experiences. It's a wonderful industry where someone can join that's really, like you said earlier, you know, almost a fish out of water and be given these experiences and then given these opportunities to make a difference. I've literally gone to nearly all the continents in the world.
I know that there would be some obviously culturally specific details for each of those places that you mentioned, but overall, could you give us some insight into what we can learn, I suppose, what people are expecting or looking into the Australian industry and seeing? Are there some general ideas or points of interest that, you know, that you could share with us?
Yeah, from a customer perspective, Australia is a really attractive place to people from, you know, Asia, the Middle East, even Europe. They see Australia as clean and green, wide open spaces, literally with kangaroos on the back doorstep. And what they're trying to capture by purchasing Australian meat is that image. And we often forget when we bury our head in detail that reputation of Australia is so valuable around the world. You go to these big cities in Asia, and, you know, thinking of China in particular, where there is just miles of concrete. You know, you don't see any grass or trees When those people come to Australia, they look up and they see blue sky and open spaces, and it's, you know, it's an out-of-the-world kind of experience. And that's a kind of, when we talk about clean green and Australia's reputation, that's what we're trying to capture. This is truly a lucky country from that perspective. And, you know, if we can sell a little bit of that, it might sound a little bit corny, that's a really valuable thing that we should protect. Everyone loves, you know, our customer, everyone loves coming to Australia. I mean, maybe not at the moment, where they can't. But everyone loves coming to Australia for those wide open spaces and, you know, to meet the people. And we probably, because we live here, we forget how good it is and we forget the opportunity that it presents for us.
And we're sitting here now in, obviously the world is looking totally different to, you know, the other 95% of your career. How has that changed, you know, I suppose the way that big organisations are doing business? And also, has it had any impact on, you know, the desire for customers to buy, I suppose, even more into that clean green image?
Yeah, there's probably two parts to that. The first is it's fundamentally changed how we do our business day to day. I was talking to one of our plant managers yesterday, and Who would have thought this time last year we would take people's temperatures when they entered the building? We'd care that they stood 1.5 metres apart from everyone. We'd count how many people were in a room to see if there was 4 square metres for them. We'd be getting into their personal life and making sure that they don't carpool. We'd be interested if they, you know, we'd want to know immediately if they'd had a cough or a sniffle. And you wouldn't have found 60 or 70 hand sanitizer stations around a plant. Every time you go near a door, you walk through a hand sanitizer. Make that point, because just how proud you can be of people that can change, right? That's something that we would have never thought about doing. And you know what? That's here forever. You know, that's not going to go away. This thing won't disappear. It's just really changed the way we work. In terms of the meat industry, I think what you've seen during the pandemic is people gravitate towards what they know and trust. And my favourite photos, and we've all seen them, are supermarket shelves where you can't see a skerrick of red meat, but there's plenty of that plant-based protein or fake meat sitting there. And in spite of the hype that surrounds that plant-based protein product, people went back to what they trust. And I think if the industry can kind of continue to get behind that happy and healthy image that we have, people will gravitate towards our product. We've seen there's, in fact, a very small number of vegetarians and vegans in Australia, and I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but definitely less than 10%. Right. And what we're actually trying to do is win the hearts and minds of the people that aren't in that group, that want to continue to buy our products, and give them a reason to feel good about that choice. And we've seen that when the pressure comes on, that's exactly what they want to do. So I think you've seen that hype of plant-based protein sort of diminished. There's no doubt in my view it'll become a, you know, permanent part of the meat cabinet, if you like, or the fake meat cabinet, I should call it. But I think calls that it's one day going to replace red meat are, you know, they're just ill-founded.
And on that topic of sort of social license and plant-based proteins, I had heard a story about your, position and role in the whole live export shutdown in 2011. And in fact, I'd heard that you were standing next to the CEO of Animals Australia when that story broke. I can't imagine, the position that you found yourself in and how you were able to, manoeuvre around that and advocate for the people that you represented. Tell us that story.
What happened back then was the first story of live export cruelty or cruelty to animals based in Indonesia came out on the Four Corners program, and it generated massive consumer and community unrest or upset. I was representing the Australian Meat Industry Council at the time, and we were working tirelessly internally to try and get our hands around the issue and get some control over what was happening by taking responsibility. But that's a whole other story. But this story just continued to generate momentum. And I still remember to this day what tipped it for me, and that was a career meat worker coming into my office in a former life and saying, almost in tears, where his daughter had seen this Four Corners program, or a rerun of it, because as I said, it was just running again and again. And he was in tears because she had said, "Daddy, you don't do that." And that was the tipping point. And we did at that stage then, and it wasn't because of that particular event. It was on the back of rapidly falling meat sales in Australia, ask our government to suspend the trade until such time that we could get some new rules in place. Very difficult time, and you know, the rest is history. When they went and banned the trade, that was certainly not something that we had asked for at that time. What it taught me though was, from time to time, you're going to have issues in your industry. You're going to have things that appear unfair or outside your control, but you must, and I really underline the must, take control of them. Do things to take control of the issue for yourself, otherwise it gets taken away from you by others. good example of what I guess running around the same time, there was a large number of metal contamination issues going on in Korea. And I remember us, when I was again working somewhere else, I think it was at Tees at the time, my boss came and said straight away, let's suspend our own license. Let's stop sending product to that market until we can show that we have this under control, rather than just keep going and saying it's not someone else's problem.
Yeah. So in some ways, that live export debacle helped to write the playbook for responding to a future crisis, to, you know, getting on the front foot and taking ownership.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. It's a great lesson for industry around social license. And I think you've heard this before, I'm sure, but we should think of social licenses, they're not like a car license. You can go and get a car license, and if you're if you're not a particular age, you can get one for 10 years and you're allowed to drive no matter what. Social license doesn't work that way. It's something that you've got to work at every single day, particularly when you're in industries that some view as controversial, and unfortunately some, albeit a noisy minority, view us a little bit controversially. You've got to be contributing to your social license every single day you operate, and that's by taking that ownership and responsibility. And the one thing I will charge the live export industry for at that time, and look, it's a completely different industry now that's does take a lot of responsibility, was what was disappointing from my perspective was that real lack of willingness to take ownership of the issue.
So if we take a step back from the industry as a whole and try and identify some sort of macro trends, obviously you clearly see social license as an important issue going forward for the industry. I'm just interested in, you know, where does that stand in terms of other trends, and what do you think the industry should be focusing on? And I'm thinking things like robotics, consumer desires, objective carcass measurement, you know, and then, of course, social license. How do those things sort of tie together? And, you know, from where you're sitting, What do you think are the big ticket items?
So I think they're all big ticket issues that add bits of value. What we should always start these conversations with is never forget our clean green status, which we spoke about earlier, Australia's biosecurity system, which underpins that. So this is the system that we have across Australia that stops exotic diseases and pests getting into the country. And good old eating quality. Because if we mess up our biosecurity system, or we don't give customers what they want in terms of eating quality, I would argue none of these things matter. None of these other things will matter. Right? So we've got to make sure that while we chase some of these, I guess, newer trends down the road, that we keep the foundation stable and strong. So that'd be my first point on that. And I've watched over a number of years this industry get distracted by some trends on the way through. I would always agree we have to always respond and adapt, but we've got to also focus on what's made the industry as strong and what gives us our competitive advantage. In terms of some of those trends, and I always use environment and animal welfare and kind of interchangeably, is that we've got to remember that we sell a luxury protein around the world. Australia is a very high cost producer of beef and sheep meat, and the markets that we need to sell into are the ones that are going to pay a little bit more than others around the world. And there is a higher proportion of consumers that do care about those kind of social license elements when they're going to make a purchase decision. So we do need to continue, and as I said, to contribute to, you know, to the social license bank around making sure that we're adopting the latest measures of in welfare, we're responding to environmental concerns that people have. And look, I think MLA's carbon neutral or CN30 commitment is brilliant from that perspective, because whether you personally believe or don't believe in climate change, it's a great example, because there are lots of people that are concerned about it. And when they go into a retail or to have a food service experience, they're wanting to feel a little bit better about that decision. So to know that the industry has that aspiration, I think is, you know, it's credit to MLA for taking leadership in that area, those kind of things.
Certainly, like you mentioned earlier, getting on the front foot of issues that you can see on the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll touch if you want just briefly on objective carcass measurement and robotics. I guess I'm a strong supporter of both. One is an enabler of the other two. So objective carcass measurement is an important first step to robotics. The industry's tried to automate for 30 years that I can remember, and it's the lack of objective carcass measurement, you know, to take account of differences in animals that have limited robotics. But objective carcass measurement's more important than that, because we must continue to strive to give producers better information from our systems about what our customers want and what our customers are willing to pay for. Because we know through all the MSA science that if we give a customer exactly what they want every time, they will pay a lot more money than if they get something that's up and down. I don't know what hope a producer has of producing that animal if we're not telling them about it. So objective carcass measurement systems, you know, that precisely describe the carcass attributes, as I said, around eating quality or yield, will continue to evolve, and they should. You know, and I hope through my involvement in the industry over, you know, the next many years, I'm not going anywhere, continues to push that objective feedback and value-based marketing. Robotics, I've reflected on, because almost all manufacturing industries around the world have become more automated and mechanised. And I think you'll see that happen in the meat industry over time, you know, and as technology continues to improve exponentially. And you'll see artificial intelligence, where cameras and computers and smart algorithms will do a lot of the work that we actually thought robots could do. You've got cameras at the moment that can pick people out of a crowd based on their behaviour. Those cameras are certainly capable of picking different pieces of meat and maintaining traceability.
And while we're on the topic of carcass measurement and robotics and the future of that sort of manufacturing side of things, I know that you've been a key supporter of the ICMJ for a long time now. Why have you incorporated that into your, you know, very busy life? I'm sure there's plenty of things that you could be doing. Why have you continued to support ICMJ for so long?
Look, and I'd say the ICMJ is the single most important investment the industry makes in development of the next generation, or the development of its capability. You don't need to be too clever to figure out that what we need as our systems advance in the industry, as our decisions have to become more data driven, that we have to make better use of all the data that has been generated about the products that we sell around the world, that we need a bunch of young, smart people that have gone to university that want to work in our industry. And what amazes me every year is that you get this big bunch of people that are obviously very smart, going to university, the majority of which live in rural Australia, which get together, give their own time to compete in ICMJ. And I think those types of people are just perfect for our industry, and we need, whilst our industry is built and will continue to rely on tradespeople that use tools every day and they're very, very good and professional at what they do, we're going to continue to need more and more university-educated people, not because of what they necessarily learn in those courses, but how they think and how they're taught to solve problems, to come into these businesses and hopefully one day take them over and run them instead of me, right? Because I know one thing: in the next 10 years, I need to recruit a whole bunch of people that are a lot smarter than me if we're going to be really successful.
And you seek and you look through, I suppose, ICMJ alumni to do that? Is that, you know, when you see ICMJ on someone's resume, is that, that's an attractive thing for you?
Very much so, because, again, it's people that, obviously interested in our industry to a degree because they've elected to do ICMJ. They've put themselves forward to compete. They've got a strong willingness to learn. And they've, I think, stepped out of their comfort zone to experience something different. Recruited that tease numbers of people out of ICMJ, and can I say they were our best decisions for recruiting people. And it's great to see some of them going on into, you know, different positions in, you know, an MLA and, you know, different companies and going from strength to strength.
Now, you've hired many, many people over the years, obviously. So my last question for you today, Tom McGuire, is what are you looking for and what do you think the industry needs in the coming years? I will point out that at the beginning of this interview today, you said that you have a bit of a smile to yourself when you ask people, what do you want to do, you know, in the next 5 or 10 years? Because if someone had asked you that at the beginning of your career, you wouldn't have necessarily said, you know, where your career ended up going. So is there a correct answer to that question? And, you know, what are you as an employer looking for?
I don't think there is a correct an answer to what I want to do in the next 5 or 10 years. What I'm looking for is someone that says, I want to experience a lot of things. I'm willing to try a lot of things. I'm willing to listen and ask questions. And what you find over time almost always is it may not be the first few things we try, but they find something that they really enjoy. What we're looking for is people that are good at building relationships with others. Nothing good is ever achieved doing it by yourself. I mean, everything in business and in life requires the help of others when you think about it. And looking for people that are willing to think a little bit differently and apply what they've learnt to what we do. Except that there are a lot of people in these businesses and it's very hard to join a big meat business because they have very strong cultures generally and there's a long established way to do something. But people that come into our business and are willing to offer suggestions and add what they can add, you know, bring to the table what they bring, which is, you know, often unique, et cetera. That's the kind of person we're looking for. It's, of course, we need technical skills from time to time. I mean, you can't go and hire a new engineer that's a doctor. Right, you need someone that, you know, you do need technical skills, but that ability to build relationships and, you know, get people working with you is just so important. And I guess my last point is a willingness to take some time. Nothing good happens instantly. And, you know, you hear it so often that, you know, good things take time and you have to be willing to do the hard yards. There are so many people that you look at that we say are successful and we attribute their success to overnight. And those people will almost always look back at you and say, yes, I've worked tirelessly for the last 5 years for my overnight success.
So there's no such thing as overnight success. Is that what you're telling me? That's bad news.
No, that's called luck, I think. But there are so many people that we look up to and that we think are really successful, but really what you've seen from them is commitment and hard work over a long period of time that, yes, one day has manifested itself in success.
This podcast is an initiative of the Australian Intercollegiate Meat Judging Association to showcase the career paths within the meat processing industry. ICMJ is a not-for-profit association which aims to provide opportunities for students to learn, building the pool of intelligent young meat industry representatives into the future. For more information, head to the website icmj.com.au.